you recognize that? The best known, perhaps arguably the most gifted cellist that the world has known, Yo-Yo Ma. Yo-Yo Ma is in his early 50s and is incredibly accomplished, winning over 15 Grammy Awards. He picked up the cello at age 4, performed for President Kennedy at age 7. At 2008, President Obama's inaugural event, he was playing there. He is known throughout the world indeed. He's born of Chinese parents in Paris. And one of the interesting things that he tells about his life, and it seems to have ordered the way in which he leans into life and sometimes upsets people, but he will be indeed his own person and following this particular drive, is that when he was a young boy, when he would come home from school, his mother would not ask him, "Did you eat all your lunch? Or did you behave yourself today? Or what did you learn?" His mother would ask him, "Yo-Yo, did you ask any really good questions today?" And Yo-Yo Ma talks about how that inspired him to be curious, to be inquisitive, not to be afraid to look like a fool if you did not know something. Ask the question. It seems to me that the disciples would have been well served to have had a mother like Yo-Yo Ma. Don't you think? For as the story begins in Mark's Gospel, we hear of Jesus leaving the crowds and leaving a territory to come apart. He did not want the folks and the crowd to know where they were because he was teaching his disciples. He understood the importance and the value of setting aside time for a certain kind of pedagogical life, for instruction and wisdom and coaching and mentoring, exploring and disclosing things to them alone. But what he had to say to them was difficult for them to hear. We can only imagine because of their response. The disciples have gathered around and Jesus calls them together and says to them, "The Son of Man will be handed over into mortals' hands and they will kill him. He'll be crucified, but he will rise again." And the text tells us they did not understand what he was saying. But even more troublesome, the text goes on to say, they were afraid to ask him anything. Have you ever been afraid to ask questions? Were you that rare student, because there don't seem to be many of them, who didn't care what other people in the class thought, would put their hands up and say, "Teacher, I don't understand a word you're saying. I don't get it." And there's a collective silent, mind you, sigh of relief from many others in the class because they don't understand either, but nobody wanted to look stupid. Anybody relate to that? It's not only when you're a student. It may be at work, it may be in your social club or your sports club or whatever, the coach has said something. You don't understand it, but you don't want to let on that you don't know. You are afraid to ask. We're so concerned about our stature and our status. We're concerned about looking smart, looking well-heeled in terms of our intellectual prowess, that we do not want anyone to figure out that there are huge gaps of ignorance in our knowledge base. And so we pretend and we go along and we smile and we fake it. You and I know, if we're honest, that gets us in trouble. It gets us in trouble not only in performance, not only on an exam. It gets us in trouble with ourselves because we're not being honest with ourselves. Let's try a little experiment. Jesus has just said some tough stuff to the disciples. What do you think they should have asked him? This is not a rhetorical question. I really want to hear. What do you think the disciples should have asked Jesus when he said, "The Son of Man will be handed over to mortals and they will crucify him, they'll kill him, but he'll rise again"? Close the book. What should they have asked? Why? Why he would be handed over? That's a good place to start. What else should they ask him? What do you mean? What are you talking about? Can you explain it? Can you tell us a little bit more? Part of the reason, I believe, and this is revealed later, is that, you see, questions are disclosive. In other words, they reveal something. Let me try something. Are you going to finish that last piece of cake? Now, that's a question. What do you think it's disclosing? You want it. You're hoping they won't finish that last piece of cake. Right? Are we there yet? How many of you have heard that? Or maybe we could have coffee sometime? Says hopefully for a new relationship that may be budding. You see, questions are disclosive. They reveal something. So you can't hide really well behind a question. So if you voice the question, it says something about you. I believe the disciples were afraid to ask something because we learn very soon after, what were they doing on the road? Do you remember? They were arguing about who was the greatest, who's the best, who's number one. If they were to dare ask Jesus a question about what you meant when their hearts were harboring pretentious aspirations to one-up each other, they could only have thought, Jesus will find me out, maybe. Will discover what's really going on. You see, Jesus has said this to them before. He said to them, because Jesus knew that his mission was to come and to be the revealer, the discloser of the reign of God, the way God intended things to be. But that was going to run up against the status quo, against the authorities, against the powers that be. And he knew, because people, this had happened to people before, that when that happens, you're going to end up dead. And he asked them this before, and they said, "Oh, no, this can't happen to you." Peter says, "No." And Jesus had to say, "Get behind me, Satan. Get behind me, tempter. You don't know what you're talking about." So they may be a little gun shy. They're not quite sure. They don't understand how their Messiah, how could this one who comes representing God be somebody who ends up in the hands of evil people, defeated? What kind of God is that? That wasn't what they signed up for when Jesus said, "Follow me, leave your net." So they had trouble with the question because it was going to reveal some ignorance, some knuckleheadedness, some arrogance. Remember, the story has just come from that tale of them not being able to exorcise a demon in a boy that had been gripped. They couldn't do it. Jesus said, "This kind requires prayer." They couldn't do it. If they're arguing also about who is greatest, perhaps they don't want to look bad in the eyes of the others. They don't want to be the one to look stupid. Right now, maybe they're checking off their list. "Oh, I got a few answers right when he asked us a parable. I'm one up on you. I did a better healing than you." They're thinking about the cohort of disciples and are afraid to ask. I want to suggest to you, questions, although they are revelatory, they disclose and open us up, are so necessary. Yo-Yo Ma's mother, I can hear, "Did you ask any really good questions today?" So maybe you don't want to call them out loud, but what questions do you have for God? What are the questions, the burning questions that you maybe have been told you shouldn't ask these things? That's impolite. That's showing not enough faith. What has tried to muzzle the true and genuine questions of your heart? Why is there so much suffering? Why do evil people just seem to get away with stuff? Why do some people who are beaten down just have so much piled on them in life? Why am I picked on at school? Why can't I perform like everybody else? What's wrong with me? What are the questions you want to ask to God? They are permitted. They are welcomed. You see, one of the concerns that the disciples had was not knowing sufficiently their heart. And this is something that James addresses in the text today that was read. He said the reason there are quarrels and fights and disharmony and all that's going on is because of what you harbor in your heart. It's prideful. It's arrogant. How many of you stood in line, or maybe you didn't, but picked up the iPhone 5 this week? Nobody wants to admit it, maybe. Very interesting thing about the phone is twice as fast as the iPhone 4. It's got a larger screen. There's a little bit of glitch. I don't have one, but I was just watching the coverage and listening to people. A glitch with the map. You know, they didn't want to have Google Map on it anymore, so they used their own, but it's all messed up. But they'll fix that, I'm sure. It's still way ahead of the field. Apple is. Steve Jobs, way, way, way back, visited Xerox one time, and he was fascinated by something that they were experimenting with. It was way, way, way back before this was popular. It had to do with the user interface, so the way in which you interface with a computer before it was keys and code and so forth. But now, as you know, there's touch screen, and you can pinch and open and all kinds of things. And Xerox was the one that had started this, and he saw this, and he took the idea, and he ran with it. And he ran with that idea because he was concerned about having such a beautiful interface. He said, I want to make the interface with this instrument so beautiful, people will want to lick it. That's what he said. But I want to suggest to you that the interface doesn't get at the real issue. That's how we connect and get along, supposedly. What's really at the core, essential to examine, is the OS, the operating system. The heart of the phone, the heart of the system. That's what James is getting at. What's the operating system? What's going on inside of you that is causing you to be jealous of others? That causes you to be so insecure about your capacities, that you have forgotten that you are called to be, not primarily do. Be my disciples. Be a servant. Be a follower of me. Be a lover of God. Be a lover of others. Be first, do after. When your operating system is in place, is being refined and transformed and ordered in the way of God, the way in which you interface is going to be different. Not only the questions you ask, but the unity that you promote. James is saying all of this discord is happening because you are puffed up. Back then, as is now, in various churches, there were gifted leaders. There were people who saw great things happening, and they began to think it was mostly them, or maybe even only them, and not God. And so they were so proud and so arrogant that discord and disorder was following. James is arguing for a humility and a wisdom that comes from God. And he says, this good life will follow that wisdom. But it's not the good life that we have been spoon-fed. It's not all the cars and the great square footage in the house and the boats and the cottage and the vacations. The good life that we are told about, that's not what James is talking about. He's talking about the kind of good life that recognizes the value and the worth and the dignity of others. The good life that recognizes the supremacy of God and God's way of doing things. The good life that turns the values of our society in many ways upside down. And that's what Jesus demonstrates when he says to these arrogant and pompous disciples who are arguing about who's number one. He says, if you want to be first, notice he says be, not do. If you want to be first, then you must be last of all, the servant of all. You need to understand what humility and the power of humility. You need to understand the very heart and nature of God. God is a vulnerable God who comes to us as the human Jesus, opening to pain and abuse and rejection and crucifixion and death. You need to understand what it means to be humble. But more than that, you need to understand that when you are going through things yourself, because none of us is without issue or problems, it does not prevent us from welcoming the child or welcoming others. This past week, I was invited to address one of the federal government departments for their United Way campaign launch. I was supposed to come in and be the motivation speaker. I was told this is, and you know, because many of you here also experience either yourself or family members, it's a difficult time in the federal service at this time with the fiscal restraints. People are affected. People are having to compete for jobs with their colleagues. We saw what happened in the news story recently. Someone who was suffering from a mental illness took his own life, could not deal with it. It was too stressful. And the concern of those organizing this campaign is that they're recognizing that it's a challenging time. People are looking at what's going to happen to me. How am I going to survive this? And there are legitimate concerns about employment and so forth. But when it was suggested indeed that we remember the United Way campaign and the agencies that are supported that work with vulnerable peoples all over the place, is it possible and is there room in the dignity of our character and the nobility of our humanity to open up and be concerned of others even though we're worried about ourselves? One of the things I said to that gathering, I reminded them of the story on which that film Out of Africa was made. You remember that? Karen Blixen-Bernicke, the baroness who came to Kenya, bought land and operated a coffee plantation played by Meryl Streep. In fact, the film was released in 1985. It finished filming in 1984, just into the beginning of 85. Just the same time I was in Kenya, people was all abuzz about what had happened as they wrapped up filming. Wonderful story, but there's a particular scene that I drew their attention to in which there, one night, a huge fire destroyed the barn and the coffee plantation, all the equipment just decimated it completely. Great grief fell over her as she looked. She did not have insurance and knew that she could not rebuild. Of course she felt sad. This was a tragedy. She loved being there. But she was able to surmount that personal tragedy and anxiety to be concerned about the people with whom she worked. Those who worked with her. Those of the native Kenyans who operated the farm. And she was invited to meet the new governor, Joseph, who had come. There was a dinner that was sponsored and she went and she spoke with him. And she said, "Oh, Baroness, I've heard of your tragedy. I'm sorry. Then you know of also what I want." Meryl Streep's character says, "Yes, the land. You want some land." And the officials of the governor started to move in closer to hush her up. And you remember that scene where she gets down on her knees and she holds the governor's hand and she pleads. She said, "Africa is a very difficult place for women. But there is some chivalry here, and I'm begging you, take care of these people. Let them have some land. They have nothing. We came here and we took their land away. Let them have some land." And of course, getting very flustered, and this is not decorum, as you can appreciate. And he says, get up. And she says, "I've lost a lot, but I'm not too ashamed to beg." And she does get up and holds his hand and says, "Do I have your word?" And he hesitates. And the governor's wife steps in and shakes Karen's hand and says, "You have mine." And a backward glance at her husband. If the wife says so, Governor Joseph's got to follow, you would think. Personal tragedy, difficulties abound. That's true. But it does not stop us from doing what Jesus is asking, to be servants to others, to be concerned about others. And Jesus brings a child into the midst. And he says, "Whoever welcomes this child welcomes me. And whoever welcomes me welcomes the one that sent me." Now, the significance of this may be lost on us because our views and understanding of children is very different today than first century Mediterranean culture in Palestine. Children occupied a precarious place in those days. There was almost 30% mortality rate at birth. By age 3 or 4, another 30% of the children in those days died. Children were prized and loved, but there was an ambivalent relationship with them. Children had lower status than slaves. Slaves could own property. Children could not. They had no voice. They had no standing. When Jesus says, it's not a romantic notion of childhood. They longed for them to live, but they knew that as they got attached, they would die off. Children just died. That's what they did. In times of poverty, in times of dislocation, in times of famine, children were the most vulnerable. If you look in Mark, look at how children are depicted. They're the ones who are suffering from disease, the boy, the demoniac, Jairus' daughter. They're the ones that are sick, the ones that are vulnerable. Jesus says, if you welcome the children, if you welcome the vulnerable, the voiceless, the hurting, you welcome me. You want to be great? Come, let me show you how to be great. Go and seek out those who have little voice, little resource, who are trampled upon by the machinery of society. You want to be great? Seek them out and welcome them. Because when you welcome them, you welcome me. And you not only welcome me, you welcome the one who sent me. Questions and greatness. Ask the questions. We here at Parkdale want to be a safe place where questions are welcome. All kinds of questions. Ask the questions. Wrestle with God in your spiritual lives. Open up with honesty. Let it disclose what you don't know and what you yearn for, what your soul wants. And you will discover what it means to be great in the eyes of God. Thanks be to God. Amen.